Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Well, today we're talking about two subjects that I know many of you are interested in. One is about animals and animal behavior, and the other is about how we can live more sustainable lives. We're going to be looking at some ways to tell if a company is really eco-friendly or if they're just saying they're eco-friendly. I read that almost one third of American consumers are now looking at is this company, is this product, is this service eco-friendly? That goes into their buying decision today. And my second guest is the former editor-in-chief of the Audubon magazine and the editor of the Whole Grain Catalog. He's joining us around 12:30 to shed some light on how we can make more informed choices. And I was really surprised at some of the information in there. But first, I know from many of your emails that we have a lot of serious animal lovers out there. And I'm wondering how many of you have left the TV or radio on for your pet while you're out and about. I admit I have. And in the days when we had answering machines where you could screen calls and I was a little longer than I thought, I've even called home to say, I'm coming home soon. Well, my first guest today is a cognitive scientist who says, hold on a minute. That may or may not work. We're going to find out. Dr. Alexandra Horowitz has spent years studying animals and their behavior, from humans and rhinoceroses to bonobos and dogs. She currently teaches psychology at Barnard College, Columbia University, and she's a former staffer of The New Yorker. Her new book is called Inside of a Dog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. Alexandra Horowitz, welcome.
Thanks.
Well, I've been, as I said before the show, looking forward to talking to you about this because based on some of your research, it seems that we have some pretty common misconceptions about what our dogs really do see, smell, and know. So, tell us.
Absolutely.
Yeah, tell us how you came, how you got interested in this research, first of all.
I was studying comparative cognition. So, I was looking at the cognition of lots of different animals and kind of contrasting it or seeing how it was similar to how we think. Nobody was really studying dogs, though, and it suddenly occurred to me that they were the perfect research subject. They were widely available, and in some ways, though they're familiar, they're pretty mysterious to us. We don't really know that much about their experience of the world, and I started studying dogs with my entree into dog parks being my own dog, Pumpernickel, who I'd lived with for many years.
And what breed is Pumpernickel, so we can visualize Pumpernickel?
Well, she's no longer, but she was a mixed breed. It's a kind of curly-coated, barrel-shaped Labrador-like dog. You know, like all mixes, unique.
Mm. And you say in the book that there's very little research has been done on dogs. For what reason, do you think?
I think that originally the most interesting animals for psychologists to study were those who were closely related to us, and that's because we expect to find similarities between other primates, chimps and monkeys, and ourselves, and we don't necessarily expect to find a lot of similarities between animals who are more distantly related to us and ourselves. And also I think that dogs were considered well-known. You know, we're so familiar with them. They're in our homes. There's certainly lots of literature about dogs and about training dogs, so they were almost not considered an exotic animal to study. Those two things combined were turned on their heads, I'd say, in the late 90s when a few researchers in Europe started studying dogs and found that they actually performed a lot better at some of the tasks psychologists devised than the chimpanzees did.
Oh, interesting, yeah. You say it's all too easy for us to forget that dogs are adapted from wild animals, you know, and you also say in the book that many trainers say, you know, don't forget your dog is an animal, but it's not quite that simple. You say they're not simple humans and they're not friendly wolves. Mm. How do you describe them?
Right, well, it's some bit of both, really. I mean, they are animals who are adapted by virtue of being selected by humans over hundreds and thousands of years to be a little more human-like. In other words, to have behaviors that we find agreeable or at least recognizable, things like gazing at our eyes, looking us in the eyes. Most wild animals don't do that. Gaze can be a threat. Between wolves, it can be a threat. But between humans, it's sort of appealing. So we bred that into our dogs. On the other hand, if we just treat them like they are humans, then we're going to be quite disappointed and surprised that some more wild-like behaviors come out now and then.
Mm. What is it? You've studied humans as well. So what do you think it is in us that makes us want to humanize our dogs and our cats?
Absolutely, right. And more than that, you know, we humanize pretty much all animals that we come into extended contact with. I think it's a way of trying to explain their behavior, and we use ourselves as a model. So it's a kind of natural thing for us to do. And in many ways, we might not be wrong with some of our projections that we make onto animals, but there's certainly very little evidence that we're always right. And there's some great examples of this in the book. Can I offer you one? It's of the dog kisses. This is one of my favorite examples. We view the great greeting of a dog, of an owner coming home, by licking her face as a kiss. We call it a kiss, even,
right.
And it's as though it's a sign of affection, and we view it as a sign of love. But among wolves, we see the very same behavior between members of a pack and a wolf who's returning from a hunt. The members of the pack all mob the returning animal and lick around his face, and they're not showing their love. They're asking him to regurgitate a little bit of that hunt for them, mm-hmm. and we know that because he often does. And they eat it up appreciatively. So it's more probable that that's what our dog is doing with us as well.
There you go. Busted one of my bubbles there.
I'm so sorry. I'm sure there's some affection in there too, but it's a combination.
Well, let's talk about their senses. You talk about the basic equipment of a dog: nose, eyes, ears, and mouth. What is their primary sensor?
It's their nose. They smell the world first. When we awaken and we see the world, they awaken and they smell the world. And no doubt this means that they visualize through their nose the world a lot differently than we do. I think sight is their second most dominant sense, and then on the rest compete for dominance.
I was thinking about this when I was preparing my notes, and you know, I've been in the kitchen several times in this circumstance. I've got the microwave going on, I have the fan going on over the hood of the cooker, I've got the electric kettle on, I might have the stereo or the TV on in the background. My dog's way in the back of the house on his bed, for all intents and purposes, fast asleep. And I might drop a little, you know, a couple of crumbs in his dish, and before I know it, he's right at his dish. And it amazes me how he can hear that with all of that other stuff going on.
That's right. Well, what you're seeing there is a perfect example of how they organize their sensory world differently than we do. For us, those are sounds competing for interest, for our auditory interest. For the dog, those sounds might not be interesting at all. So they're all one kind of sound, and he's listening for a sound that contrasts with that sound, a sound that indicates food or a door opening or something that would be interesting to him.
Mm. You say they can literally hear bugs vibrating.
Yeah, at least in theory, they can hear high enough frequencies to hear the sounds of the vibrations that bugs make to communicate, the sounds of a fluorescent lamp much more clearly and annoyingly, potentially, than we can. Presumably lots of other high-frequency sounds, which we don't even know are in our environment.
Mm. This is why my dog doesn't like my singing, then.
It's
this
possible.
Explains a lot. Let's go back to the nose a minute and talk about, you say that humans have 6 million of these sensory receptor sites, sheep, dog noses, and I have a sheepdog, I have a border collie, over 200 million, and beagle noses over 300 million. So they really, they smell everything. And you describe us in, I won't go into detail about how you describe us as being these just things that give off scent. We left skin, body odor, they smell who we've kissed, who we've touched. Talk a little bit about that and how the dog breaks it all down.
Yeah, I mean, the hundreds of millions of scent receptors more than we have, I think only gives us the beginning of an indication of how much more acute their sense of smell is. They're attuned to extremely small differences in concentration of an odor, so they can tell when which way somebody was walking by the difference in the concentration of an odor in their steps. They certainly know a lot about us and our identity by our scents, the various scents that we wear on our body. And when we cover up our scent by putting on a new perfume or coming from a smoky environment, this might cause them a little bit of puzzlement first until we do something familiar or we speak to them and are then recognizable as ourselves. So I think their scent world is an entirely parallel universe to the world that we live in.
Mm. And you talk in the book about how they smell disease, and even I've noticed eczema, dogs can smell eczema on the skin. Do they really smell disease, or is it just a change in scent?
They seem to be able to distinguish cancerous cells from non-cancerous ones. And I should caution that these are dogs who have been trained to do so. So presumably many or all dogs have the ability to do it, but they still have to have their attention brought to that. You know, you wouldn't just go around sniffing a human and pointing out, gee, that mole should really be checked out. You know, they have to be instructed that it's important to us.
Right,
to have
that's
right. Checked out. But it does seem as though, yes, they can distinguish between a cancerous cell and a non-cancerous cell. They can also, in some way we don't quite yet know, they seem to be able to predict seizures, which are about to happen in epileptic patients, the result being that they can warn their owners that a seizure is about to happen and the epileptic can get to a safe position so that they don't fall and hurt themselves during a seizure.
Yeah, I just saw a TV segment on that where dogs were trained to sniff out peanut butter and diabetic shock and epilepsy. It was quite fascinating.
Mm.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue talking to Dr. Alexandra Horowitz. Her new book is called Inside of a Dog. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, and we'll be right back.
Chatting with a cheetah, what a neat achievement it would be. If we could talk to the animals, learn their languages, maybe take an animal degree, we'd study elephants.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to brighten your day.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Asking over crocodiles for tea, or maybe lunch with two or three lions, walruses and sea lions. What a lovely place the world would be. We'd learn to speak in antelope and turtle. Our Pekingese would be extremely good. If we were asked to sing in hippopotamus, we'd say why none of us, and would.
Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Alexandra Horowitz about her new book, Inside of a Dog, What Dogs Really Smell and See and Hear. And I've got a bunch of questions that I want to ask you, Alexandra, a bunch of why questions. And a couple of these come from listeners. You've already busted the delusion about, you know, does my dog really love me if he kisses me? Can dogs really sense the time?
Well, I think this is an interesting puzzle. It looks like since smells themselves exist in time, in other words, they sort of tell time with their a concentration of an odor indicates how old it is. A very strong odor is newer, a weaker odor is older. It looks like dogs probably can sense time in smell. So what they're doing when they're sniffing into the breeze is sort of smelling a little bit of your future, what's ahead of you, and what they're doing when they're smelling what's underfoot is smelling something in the past. So their primary sensory modality allows them to see time in some sense.
Interesting. Now, many people I know leave the TV on for their dogs or radios, you know, on for their dogs if they're gone for a while. Is that a waste of time?
Well, it might have changed a little bit with this advent of digital TV, but it certainly is the case that with old TVs, what dogs were looking at, if you left the TV on for them, it was not exactly the same as what we see when we look at the TV. And this is because of a little eccentricity of their eyes. There's something called the flicker fusion rate, which is the number, really, the amount of information you can get per second, visual information. And the dog's flicker fusion rate is higher than ours. Well, these old TVs used to be images sent tuned to our flicker fusion rate. For the dog, they would see not only the stream of images, but these black lines between the images that we don't even notice, sort of like an old film that's gotten slowed in its projector, the refresh rate of the screen. So they would have been seeing the images, but interrupted by these annoying lines, and probably that interrupts the feeling of watching a scene on the television. So I don't think they were watching Lassie. They're not watching the pet channel the way we hope that they are. That doesn't mean it couldn't be a diversion, and they'll be interested in noises and maybe even recognize some forms on the TV. Yeah. But it wasn't the diversion we hoped.
You have a theory about, you know, I walk my dog. One of the parks I walk him at is in Steilacoom Dog Park by the fort. And a lot of dogs there have little booties on and raincoats and hats. What do they really think of those clothing?
I think that in most cases, dogs are pretty cooperative with this, as we have to admit they are very cooperative with lots of trials that we put them through. But the feeling of a coat pressing down on their back is probably not a comfortable feeling at all. If we look at wolf behavior, again, their ancestors, a dominant wolf might stand over or press down on the back of a subordinate wolf when he's punishing him. So the feeling of a close-pressing garment is probably the feeling that a dominant animal is standing somewhere near you, punishing you.
Oh,
they'll put up with it with us, but it's not any fun.
That explains it. I haven't dressed a dog up since I was 7 years old. And my sister and I, we had two Pekingeses when we were children, Babs and Buttons. And I had to have Babs because she was the grumpy one. And my sister had Buttons because she could just dress him in everything. And we'd push them around in the prams like little girls do, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah, this is very, very common behavior. Dogs are very patient with us.
They are very patient. So I have some listener questions here. I want to make sure I get those answered. Lane in Sacramento said, our chocolate lab Sadie sits and stares at the wall, always in the same spot. Sometimes she growls and her hackles come up. And then all of a sudden she'll wag her tail and run off. My wife thinks we have a ghost. What is she really staring at?
Well, that's a truly interesting question. You know, dogs don't have, especially labs, can't see very well right in front of them. So their eyes are not set up to focus on things directly at kind of paw length. And so if she's staring right at the wall, she's probably not looking at the wall so much, but maybe it's a good place for a breeze to come by. For instance, in the normal movement of air in a room includes air moving up along the walls as the day goes on and then sort of over the across the ceiling and out the windows. Maybe there's a bit of a gust of air from outside coming through that we don't notice that carries a smell of a marauding cat or a neighboring dog, and this is what your dog is sniffing for.
Maybe even termites in the wall, because you said they can smell those.
or it's hear absolutely them. Possible yeah. that it's not the wall per se. I think that's the key. Even though it looks like
right.
she's looking at the wall, it's something beyond behind the wall or something that we can't see in front of the wall. Yeah.
Interesting. And Mary B. says, my dog looks in the mirror, and my dog has done this too, and growls. Is she seeing herself? Does she think she's looking at another dog? What's going on?
Right. I think that dogs, there's a test in cognitive psychology called the mirror self-recognition test. Children pass this test at about age 2, where they suddenly realize that that one who's in the mirror, that is themselves. Before that, they use the mirror. They can look in the mirror, but they don't seem to recognize that it is they in the mirror. And dogs don't pass this test. So while dogs are pretty good at using the mirror to see if somebody's coming up behind them, for instance, in other words, using the features of the mirror, they don't seem to recognize themselves. So your dog growling at the mirror might think that there is a strange, non-smelly dog approaching them in the mirror.
Right.
And even more infuriating would be that as you walk toward them growling, they walk towards you growling, sort of just perpetuating the fantasy.
Oh, interesting. It's quite fascinating. You have quite a study in there talking about the chimps and how they reacted too. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yeah, my book started out as a desire to put into prose for the general reader all of these academic studies that have popped up now about dog cognition. And then I got interested in doing a slightly different turn with it, and the final book turned out to be an attempt to use scientific data, and that's about not just dog cognition, but about their sensory abilities, about their history, evolutionary history, to try to imagine what it's like to be a dog, to get at the dog's point of view.
Yeah, and you run little stories through here about your dog, too.
Yes. Yeah, she is, of course, a focal point in my mind as I'm doing my research or reading about others' research, how I could apply that to what her experience might have been like.
Mm. You said in the book you were lucky enough to play with dogs for a year. Watch dogs play for a year. What did you learn about yourself, if anything? Because I've learned things about myself from my dog.
From watching dogs. I think I learned how to be an observer, I can say that. I realized that there was a lot that I was missing when I thought I knew what was going on with my dog, or when I think I know what's going on in interacting with somebody else, even another human being. And that by observing carefully, as opposed to just thinking I know what's happening, I learned something new about the creature.
Mm. What surprised you the most?
I think that dogs being able to smell the passage of time is very surprising. In my play research, I was really surprised to see that what looked like really rambunctious, unformed play was moderated by specific rules, and that dogs could use each other's attention and know if another dog was paying attention and gauge the level of inattention in trying to get someone to keep playing with them, so that what looked like chaos actually was pretty structured.
Oh,
I was impressed.
Yeah. Oftentimes, if a dog has misbehaved and he's used to his owner and what they expect, they get this guilty look about them. What's going
right.
on with that? Is it a real look of guilt? Do they really feel guilt?
We did an experiment recently where we tried to find out what prompted that guilty look, the ears pressed back and the tail between the legs. And it looks like it appears most often, not when they've done something actually wrong, although it does appear when they've done something wrong, but most often when they're being scolded or about to be scolded. And so my estimation is that this look is a learned look. You know, you don't see a puppy do this before he's ever been scolded, however gently, for anything. Instead, they learn that certain behaviors lead to an angry owner, perhaps, or even just a harsh word or a reprimand. And they put on this look, this very sweet, submissive look, to try to avoid the punishment. If they experience guilt, and I'm not sure if they do or not, we can't tell, and they're not telling us, this guilty look doesn't seem to be an indication of it.
Interesting. It's because I know when I first had my dog, he never chews anything, but he did the first 2 days I had him, he chewed his bed.
Yeah.
And the second day, before I even saw him and saw the bed, he came creeping up to me really, really with a guilty look on his face. But
right. Well, I think they learn very quickly an association between potential behavior and your reaction.
Yeah.
And they'll act to avoid a punishment. But guilt is a very complicated emotion that would understand, you know, you'd need to understand that there's a moral code that we all behave by and that they may have violated it.
Right.
And so I don't want to attribute that to them without real proof of it.
Right.
On the other hand, they definitely know what's right or wrong in that case.
Right.
And they're realizing that some rule that they violated might lead to a punishment. So it's a very small step from that to guilt, but it's a step.
Yeah. Now, obviously, when we take a pet home, at some point they're going to die. What do they know that they're going to die? How do we help them through that transition?
Yeah, I think that science hasn't really well addressed that question. My personal feeling is that they are not thinking about their mortality in the way that we are. At least they're not anticipating it, sort of with the dread or with concern or with religion and belief the way that we are. But they do seem to know something about the death of other animals and, you know, notice their absence and even mourn for an absent owner or a companion, animal companion. So I don't think we need to imagine that they're fearing death themselves. They might not know anything about their own death. And if that's the case, more power to them. I'd rather they not know.
Yeah. Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Alexandra. But before we go, I want to get this in because you say it's important to let your dog roll in smelly smells sometimes and traipse through mud puddles and walk off leash when you can and let dogs smell each other's rumps. Because I've seen a dog park, a lot of people don't allow their dogs to do that. And you say it's important to let them play.
I think so. We sometimes forget that they're dogs in a way. You know, we expect them to behave according to a code of behavior that is a human code of behavior.
Right.
And, you know, absolutely, you don't want them to roll in something foul every day and you have to bathe them. But, you know, they want to splash through that puddle. It really does very little harm. They get so much enjoyment out of it. I think the owner who lets them do it now and then will get vicarious enjoyment by watching their dog be doggy.
I think so, too. And if listeners want to find out more about your book, they can go to insideofadog.com, insideofadog.com. And the book, again, is insideofadog, What Dogs See, Smell, and Know. And the author, Dr. Alexandra Horowitz. Thank you so much for being with us, Alexandra.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Vicky.
And please stay with us. Coming up next, the editor of the Whole Green Catalog, Michael Robbins, joins us next. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Hi, I'm Terry with tsigns.com with a quick tip for you. Next time you're crawling through traffic, think of it as promoting your business on the road. Reach potential new clients with custom-designed vehicle graphics, from a classy removable door sign to a full car body wrap, or a simple but effective window decal. We can do it all. We're a family-run business here to help new customers find you. See tsigns.com for a personal guarantee or call Terry today at 206-971-6800. Again, 206-971-6800.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicky St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicky asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. and visit AndreaKay.com. That's AndreaKay.com for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
If you like to read fiction, check out Book Talk Podcast Reviews, brought to you weekly by Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Go to conversationslive.net and click on the menu at Book Talk to hear reviews of an eclectic range of books. We review fiction from chick lit and mystery to suspense and literary, from new to old, overlooked and forgotten. Check out Book Talk Podcasts today at conversationslive.net. If you'd like to suggest a book for review, email info@conversationslive.net or call 206-414-6159.
Tell your friends the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. Well, as consumers drive up the demand for green products and services, more companies are jumping on the green bandwagon. How do we as consumers distinguish between companies who are truly engaging in sustainability and those that are exaggerating their green claims just to get us to buy? Well, that's something my next guest can help us clarify. Michael Robbins is the former editor-in-chief of the Audubon magazine. He's written articles for publications such as New York, Discover, Mother Jones, Plenty, and Popular Science. And he's the winner of a National Magazine Award. Michael Robbins is currently a magazine editor for the Wider Group, History Group, and he's the author of several books and the editor of the Whole Green Catalog, 1,000 Best Things for You and the Earth. This book has some amazing information in here. Welcome, Michael Robbins.
Thank you, and I'm very happy to be on the show.
Well, I want to know how long it took you to put this book together, because it is, 400 pages?
Yes.
It's a big catalog for anyone who's watching on video cam. Too big to put out
yes,
there.
It is quite big. From concept to publication was about 3 years. But there was about 1 year of very intense research and writing. And, of course, I didn't do it all myself. In fact, very little of it in terms of research and writing. I was the editor. We had 17 or 18 contributors, authors, who handled the specific subject areas and wrote those chapters.
Mm. And everybody's, as you said, a subject expert in their particular category. Mm-hmm. What is it you hope we'll gain from the Whole Green Catalog?
Well, there's a fundamentally simple idea at the heart of this publication, and it's I would summarize it as saying essentially, pay more attention to what you're buying, and it's to make people aware that right now in the marketplace there are many choices, of course, and in almost every area of life there is a green choice to be made as opposed to a not-so-green choice, or an even sort of counter-environmental choice. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to alert people to, and we were trying to pull a fundamental sort of minimum of those choices together in one place.
Yeah. And as you say, I think it was in, I read it on a blog, this would make actually a good gift for anyone who cares about the future of the planet and is concerned about how they spend their money and where they spend their money. And you did use 100% waste materials yourself when you were putting
yes,
this together.
Well,
I think
that's
important.
That was essential, of course.
Yeah. So over 1,000 photographs and illustrations in this. In the foreword, Bill McKibben says the catalog's job is to help us make smart choices. But the most important things that let you stop buying. So what you look at is what we can buy to help us stop, keep on buying. I can't phrase this very well. I'm not phrasing this very well. But so that we don't keep recycling.
Yeah. No, it's a fundamental idea that conservation is really one of the basic messages here, and that works out in a number of different ways. If you buy something that is not destructive, not destructive to the planet altogether, that is to say, is not going to end up in the waste stream in a non-productive way. Plastic water bottles are a perfect example. They can be recycled. but we're discarding them at the rate in this country of something like 20 to 30 billion a year, or we're buying them at that rate, and only about 80%. About 80% of them are ending up in landfills. Only about 20% are getting recycled. Now, that's a pretty destructive choice. We're just filling the landfills with material that does not biodegrade.
Yes, I got an email from a listener named Ellen because I was using paper cups. And I want you to, if you're watching on video cam, Ellen, I have my commuter mug with me today. But these are all very simple, very obvious choices we can make. Just sometimes we grow for convenience, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. As consumers, it's sometimes hard to know, distinguish between the companies that really are doing eco-friendly, sustainable products versus those who aren't. How do we tell? What's a good litmus test there for us?
Well, it's really a matter of reading the material that they're required to publish on their that comes with the product, and doing a little research. Frankly, we did the research for these products, so I can say pretty confidently that. There may have been one or two or three greenwashed objects that got by us, but for the most part, a certain amount of research is called for. Fortunately, nearly every product that we mention, and really the vast majority of the products that are available to the consumers in America today, are backed by web-accessible information. And you can really look up a company website, look at the products, and find out how they're manufactured and distributed, and how they're to be used and disposed of.
Yeah,
it's not true of everything, but there's a great deal of information out there. In this sense, the web is a great green resource.
Yeah. Well, we say we vote every time we spend a dollar. We're voting one way or the other. Mm-hmm. And maybe one of the first places we should look at is where we actually keep our money, with banks. There are actually eco-friendly banks out there. Let's talk a little bit about that, if you would.
Yes, there's a chapter here on money and how to use it and how to invest it and hang on to it and do all kinds of good things with it, but there are also a small number of banks in the United States that are committed to conservation, as we say, and that is they support companies. An example I think is Chittenden's bank in New England. They support through the use of their money businesses that are sustainable businesses, a furniture maker who makes handcrafted furniture from sustainably harvested trees, things like that. They go out of their way to support family farmers, organic farmers, sustainable agriculture, that kind of thing. So if you're banking, you're essentially giving your money to the bank to attempt to make more money with it by investing.
Right.
And
right.
Where they invest the money can make a huge difference.
Right. It definitely does. And some of the larger banks don't invest in some. Well, they invest in some very questionable projects, I think, if you really do some research on that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of the local banks you talk about is Shore Bank Pacific, which they have offices in Portland, Oregon, and Ilwaco, Washington.
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure.
It's Ilwaco.
Ilwaco in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
One of the gift ideas that I was looking at was a snowboard for one of my nephews. And you even have a huge section in here for outdoor and sports activities.
Yes. We, of course, wanted to start with, food, shelter, clothing, the essentials. But then very quickly, we want to get into other areas where Americans spend their money, because the consumer spending is essentially the largest engine of commerce in the United States, and sports and recreation accounts for a very significant portion of that.
Mm.
So there, as every place else, you can cast a green vote or a non-green vote. Bamboo is a wonderful material for projects like skateboards and snowboard sporting equipment of all kinds, because it grows rapidly, and is readily recyclable, and it also can be grown without significant herbicides and pesticide use.
Yeah. This was interesting to me, though, because I've gone for bamboo sheets and stuff like that lately because they're tree-friendly, or tree-free-friendly, I should say.
Yeah.
In the arts and crafts supplies, you do have put a caveat in there and say, beware of bamboo paper.
Yes, I'm just trying to find the notes here.
You make a point of saying that go ahead.
No, that's correct. That bamboo is a material as a substitute for sort of mainstream forestry. It's a wonderful material, but as a raw material for paper, it's not so great because paradoxically because of its very strength. To break it down into usable fiber for paper does require some pretty harsh treatment and pretty harsh chemicals. So bamboo paper is probably not a great idea. Bamboo snowboards are a good idea.
Bamboo snowboards, there you go.
Right.
I'll keep that in mind when I'm selecting.
It doesn't help you with the stationery store.
No. I wanted to go into the paper side of things just a little bit more because so many of us do use so much paper. But we'll take a quick break before we do that so that I don't have to interrupt you. We're talking today in this segment with Michael Robbins. He's the editor of the Whole Green Catalog, 1,000 Best Things for You and the Earth. It really is a fantastic resource. I was just blown away. I just spent hours just going through this. Wow, I didn't know that. So we'll talk some more when we come back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
If you missed a show on Conversations Live, check out conversationslive.net for dozens of free podcasts. Topics range from health and healing to business and career growth, from personal development to creativity, adventure, and the challenges of the human spirit. See conversationslive.net for talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. conversationslive.net, making a difference one word at a time.
Looking for unconditional love? An exercise buddy or a great listener? Paws has the dog or cat of your dreams, just waiting to meet you. We've made thousands of perfect matches since 1967 because everyone needs a warm, safe place to call home. Find out more today at paws.org or call 425-787-2500.
Does work feel like a puzzle and you don't know where all the pieces are, or you have all the pieces but you don't know what the picture should look like? Then join me, Denise Rubin, 30-year vet in human resources. I've sat in the boardroom and in the executive offices, and I'll share with you the trials and tribulations of the workplace and how together we can solve the workplace puzzle one piece at a time. Tune in to Work Does Matter, Fridays from 1 to 2 in the afternoon on Alternative Talk 1150. Visit my website at workdoesmatter.com.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to help you live well, live strong.
Spread the word. You don't have to settle for the usual talk radio. Now there's Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. We're talking in this segment with the editor of the Whole Green Catalog. His name is Michael Robbins. And I wanted to talk to you. We were talking about paper before the break, Michael. And I love this. The Exotic Paper Company, a small independent paper manufacturer in England. And they specialize in making paper from grass, from stamps, coffee, straw, human hair, currency. They make handmade papers from lavender petals, wildflower seeds. But their signature paper, Their signature papers are Elipu and Rhino Poo paper. I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, as improbable as it seems, the fact of the matter is you can make paper from almost any vegetable fiber, and actually some non-vegetable fibers. And, of course, those are animals that whose diet is healthy ones, very high in fiber, as we like to say.
Right.
And so the waste product is equally high in fiber.
Right.
So that it is a viable raw material for paper manufacturing, small batches, of course. But I have actually seen and handled and used both Elipu and Rhino Poo paper, and they're very distinctive. I wouldn't say they seem to be the kind of texture for plain old writing paper, but they certainly, for a kind of arts and crafts projects, they're very, very interesting textures and so on.
Yeah.
And, of course, needless to say, they're odor-free.
Odor-free. Well, yes, we would hope.
That would be important.
Well, the important thing about that, they're not just using natural products, they're not just recycling. Purchasing paper, that paper, helps support the Millennium Foundation in Sri Lanka, and that gives elephants a home after they've outlived their usefulness as labor animals. So it's actually going back to help endangered animals, too.
Right, right. That's a very important consideration. And if I may say so, it's one to look for when you're looking at sustainable goods. It's not just, organic cotton or fibers made of hemp or something of the sort. It's also very important to look at the activity of the companies that are doing this, because many of them do turn around and support, sustainable agriculture in home country, and really are not just green companies, but socially very responsible companies, and I think that's an important element of green living.
It is. Another important element, you do make the point in the book of saying just because something's labeled natural doesn't mean it's automatically safe. And you give the example of the madder root, which is used to produce the color red in natural dyes, and yet that's one of the most toxic substances on the planet. So we really need to know what it is we're buying.
Yeah, exactly. There are some natural substances, of course, that are destructive and very difficult to handle safely.
Mm. Well, there's a great section in there for artists, arts and crafts. My sister and my mother are both artists, and so I was looking through there, and actually a couple of the companies are in England, so I can just get online and have them ship directly their Christmas gifts from there.
Yes.
One of the things that I think is another big issue is electronics. And I was really pleasantly surprised to see how far we've come. We've all heard of the landfills and the barges abandoned that are full of recycled PCs. And I think that still is a problem to some extent. But as far as manufacturing new products, it seems that companies are coming on board with the long term in mind.
Yes, I think that's true, and it's one of the most heartening things that's happened really in recent years. The computer manufacturers, in particular, I think, had been up until just a handful of years ago, were really pretty heedless about the materials they were using, some of the impacts of on groundwater and so on, of the disposal of some of the recycled equipment, not really recycled, just tossed. A lot of toxic metals, mercury, and others that get into the groundwater. But they have made enormous strides. Dell has really made an effort to turn out computers now that are using much more safe materials and are assembled in a way that is not nearly as destructive as it used to be. And Macintosh. Apple is also doing that, and they were a little late to catch on to that, but they have been moving very quickly to green up their manufacturing process.
Yeah, one of the things you talk about on your blog is bioplastics. Samsung has three phones which have been on the market for a while, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not sure if they're available in America yet, but. Certainly something for us to look forward to, if not. And they're about 80% recyclable, which is a big difference from the phone 10 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Cell phones have just, all the companies and manufacturers have really They've all had policies in place that really encourage people to just, you know, toss the old phone and you know, buy a new one. And that has the emphasis there has begun to shift. There's still an awful lot of phones that are headed for the landfills, but Samsung has been a leader in using biodegradable materials in its manufacture. At the time this book was completed last summer, the Samsung phone, there were plans afoot for Samsung to bring these into North America, but they had not yet, so we couldn't say that they were doing that. But many other manufacturers are also working in this area.
Right. And there are websites out there where we can go check on certain things. Do you know any of those off the top of your head?
Well, there are many. The manufacturers themselves are really kind of the best source for this, although many of the green organizations also and increasingly have information on their websites. EDF, Environmental Defense Fund, for one, Rainforest Alliance, for another. Have a great deal of green information on their websites, and the companies seem to be most manufacturers seem to be coming around to the view that having green products in the marketplace is a real plus, is a real marketing edge. So most of them are really trumpeting their achievements and their plans and developments and so on in the green area. Via the websites, and we made it throughout the book a point to include a website, and I think pretty nearly every product and service that is mentioned does refer to a website.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
what's in the book is sort of just the tip of the iceberg in terms of information on these products.
Mm. Now, there's a law in the UK against excess packaging. It's enforced by the trading standards, and this is one of my big bugs. I actually bought, I'll just give you an example, I bought some Crest tooth whitening strips a few weeks ago, which would have fit in a packet the size of a cigarette packet.
Yeah.
I get this huge, great big plastic thing, container, with these little tiny strips in it.
Yes.
I could not find, when I did a very, very quick search, I didn't spend a lot of time on it, I did a very quick search to find if we had a central place here to complain about excess packaging. Are you aware of anywhere?
I don't know of a central place to complain about it. I know that complaining about it to the companies is certainly an obvious option, but I don't know that there's a central clearinghouse at this point for registering complaints. I honestly don't know where you'd start. It's just epidemic excess packaging on all kinds of products, not only excess but also remarkably. Too durable materials. I mean, I've bought things recently where I had to use real, you know, sort of blunt instruments and
right.
edged weapons in order to get into the packaging and free the batteries or whatever it was that was wrapped up. If I may, there's sort of a cultural thing going on. I think that kind of packaging began. Or at least accelerated some years ago when there was a public safety issue, a poison scare.
Yes,
when people
yeah.
were lacing Tylenol with poisons, toxic substances, and I think fearing, you know, the liabilities, manufacturers of many different kinds of products and services started packaging very, very heavily so that things could not be gotten into in the store. They could not be gotten into until you got them home.
Yeah, I think that's very true. Michael, we're almost at the end of our segment. What would you like to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I think the idea that, I think in this holiday season, I think the idea that there are many things here that might make pretty good gifts, and certainly I've been doing my own Christmas shopping in the catalog, and things that I hadn't already seen or gotten, I've been ordering, and there's high-end items like the Philips 42-inch television, the Eco TV that draws no more than 100 watts of power, like a 100-watt bulb, And at the low end, there are a lot of really attractive aluminum or stainless steel water bottles that you can fill with tap water and carry around, and avoid using those plastic water bottles that end up in the landfill.
Yeah, definitely. I'm making a concerted effort myself not to do that anymore. one thing I want to give out is your website. It's wholegreencatalog.com, wholegreencatalog.com, mm-hmm. because there is more information up there. It's a good website.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. And I really appreciate you being with us today and sharing
this
with us. Yeah, I'm going to carry on browsing through here while I pick out the rest of my gifts.
Okay, well, there are a lot of goodbyes.
Yeah, thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you very much. It was a privilege.
And I want to thank each of you for being with us today. As we leave today's show, I obviously am thinking of the Force Lane offices down in the Tacoma area, and want to send warm thoughts and good energy to their friends, family, and colleagues. And meantime, we're going to be back next week, and I want you to live well, live strong, and please join us next Monday at noon for more Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. You can reach me at 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617 if you have any questions or comments about today's show. See you next week.
Views expressed on the preceding program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. This is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM, KKNW Seattle, and KW.